Hey everyone, I'm Chris Lesniak.
And I'm Rob Beyer, and this is
the Debate Math Podcast.
Debating mathy topics and mathy pedagogy with mathy people just like you.
Let's get into this month's debate.
Hello, listeners. The episode you're about to hear includes two live debates from the Ontario Mathematics Coordinators Association, or OMCA, retreat in February of 2024. I'm so excited to share these two short live debates. Because they are live, please excuse any microphone issues you may hear in the sound, but please enjoy and let us know if you want us to host a live debate for your organization someday soon. So welcome to our live debate portion of the retreat here. I have four very brave souls who have volunteered to share their opinions in front of you. Yes, round of applause for them. I am very excited that they will be modeling what good adults debate looks like and how we can listen to each other and learn from each other. And we will be asking audience questions at some points throughout. So as you hear the discussions, if you think of something good, you want to write it down or just keep a mental note, feel free, let me know. I'll come around with microphones to take a few questions each one. We're going to have two small debates, two shorter debates in this session here. But let me first introduce our four brave educators here. So first up, first here to my left is a man who holds the record for eating the most schnitzels in a German restaurant in Toronto. It's Stephen Monica. Stephen.
Hello, everyone.
Can you tell us where you are and what you do?
I work for the Waterloo Region School Board. I guess they've heard of it. And I'm an itinerant coach, and I currently teach the 1W math course.
Thank you. Next up is a huge downhill skier who has been coached by Kate Pace. It is Kelly Madigan. Kelly, can you tell us where you're from and what you do?
Hi, Kelly. I am from North Bay. I work for Nipissing Parry Sound Catholic District School Board, and I'm currently a math facilitator K-8.
Thank you. And on the other side of things here, we have former rugby player who now likes to dabble in doodling. It is Cherry Parenthesis. Cherry, can you tell us some more about you?
Yeah, I'm from the Kawartha Pine Ridge District School Board, and I am the secondary numeracy consultant.
Thank you. And last but not least is a traveling puppet director, Angela Schaefer. Angela, tell us about you and where you come from.
I'm also from the Waterloo District School Board. Mine was louder, Stephen. And I am a teacher coach, as well as teaching grade 10 single stream.
Very good. Thank you. Again, a round of applause for all four of our debaters. So we're going to debate in three rounds. We're going to have opening statements, a question round, and then a quick closing at the end. And we're going to do this twice through with two different topics. So the first topic we decided to debate on is the statement, we need to have common evaluations. We need to have common evaluations. And here, speaking for this idea, is our record eater, Stephen Monica. Stephen, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Have you ever evaluated your students and been like, wow, I really didn't teach them this thing well? So you go to your colleague teaching the same class next door and say, what would you do differently? And the response you get is, oh, I don't teach it that way, and I don't evaluate it that way. Sorry, I got to run. Hockey practice starts in 5 minutes. All of a sudden, you're back in your teaching silo or working with your trusted friend, but not with the people who you're teaching the course with. The purpose and our motivation as teachers to assess and evaluate our students is to see that we have engaged them in learning, progress them forward, and inform our next steps. It is my claim that with more common co-created evaluation opportunities, we will better. We can better reflect on and improve our teaching practice. I have two warrants for this. Common and co-created evaluations allow for a common dialogue along what pedagogical choices to make in our classrooms to move students forward in their understanding with our colleagues. Two, data taken from common evaluations can better help coaches, coordinators, and consultants deliver more effective professional development. As you can see, common evaluations offer opportunities to improve students' understanding. I claim that we need to have common evaluations.
Thank you, Stephen. Thank you, Stephen. And arguing against the idea of common evaluations, we have Cherry Prentices. Cherry, the floor is yours.
I believe that every educator in this room would agree to the importance of getting to know our learners as a means to build relationships, identify learning needs, and tailor our instructional practices. In doing so, we must also recognize that not all learners can effectively demonstrate their understanding in the same way. Therefore, my claim is that common evaluations do not provide students with opportunity to show their understanding in a way that best suits them. And I have two warrants for this. One, common evaluations within a school severely limit teachers from being creative and innovative when designing and planning student learning experiences. For example, some teachers prefer to spiral the curriculum, while others organize by unit. In this case, other than a summative assessment at the end of the course, common evaluations would be near impossible. And even in the case of final summative assessments, common evaluations prevent educators from creating the chance for their students to reflect the type of learning and assessment opportunities that occurred in the course. Two, if we look at the EQAO, our provincial common evaluation given in grades 3, 6, and 9, inequalities become evident. This standardized assessment is used to make decisions regarding math supports and funding, yet in grade 9, there is a huge discrepancy from board to board about whether or not it counts towards a student's final grade, which online tools are available to students, not to mention that the computerized multiple choice format is in direct conflict with assessment practices many students are accustomed to. In conclusion, common evaluations do not have the capability to capture the full understanding and proficiency of our students.
Thank you, Sherry. Okay, so they've given us some good thoughts to start off the discussion. That is just the tip of the iceberg there, though. So I'm curious what questions you have, and I'm going to open these questions up to the whole panel there. What is on your mind when it comes to giving common evaluations?
What's on my mind? I would think for assessment purposes, common practices or having a common one like a diagnostic would be valuable. But I'm just curious as to why you would think a summative would be valuable. Like,
you want to take that? Why you think a summative common assessment would be valuable?
So I hear what you're asking. You're asking why would a common summative evaluation be valuable? And what I look at, as it being equitable. So I'm thinking if you say, for example, in your high school happen to have grade nine math classrooms, if you have a common evaluation, which doesn't have to be used every time, it can be equitable because then each student is getting the same type of question. So therefore, then you can look at trends and help the students improve. And then you're not measuring what type of questions the teachers ask. The teachers have come together collaboratively, designed that common assessment, and then given it to their students to help them improve.
Thank you. I had a question over here.
I wonder if the debaters could be more specific around common versus standard. It seemed like there was a conflict there.
Anybody want to take that?
For me, when I talk about a common evaluation, it would be an opportunity for students to demonstrate their learning co-created by teachers in the building. So that's what I would talk to that regard. As to a standardized test like EQAO, I think there's some value in having data that is collected. That is collected in a way that is not controlled by the teachers. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but I think there's some value in, in terms of what we do with data is what's important about data, right? So how we collect it, what we get from it, if it informs our practice, that's the part that's important. So from a standard assessment, what we do with the data and how we inform our practice to move our students forward is what's important. So that's what I was saying.
Can I just bring Sherry and Angela in the conversation? I'm going to ask a question. Thinking about, we want high expectations for students, and I want them for teachers as well. So if you think about a unique situation with a teacher who just is off doing their own thing, how do we make clear expectations if we don't have a common evaluation for what like the course is about or what this unit is about?
I hear you asking about clear expectations for the students, do you mean?
For the teacher, how do we make sure the teacher is covering whatever that means, like this material in a way that the students are understanding? If we let her make her or him make their own assessment that may not be of high quality or on topic?
Well, I feel like as teachers, we are professionals. So we have the curriculum as our document that we follow to make sure that we are covering the ministry standards that are required for us. So I don't know that an assessment would evaluate what I am covering in my classroom. I do use a lot of common assessments, but I like to have the ability to talk to a kid, pull a kid aside during them. And I do that just mainly because it's easy to collect or gather data. But Peter Liljedahl talks about like being the hunter rather than the gatherer. And when there's kids that are not able to show that work on that common assessment, to be able to go around and ask them questions and have them show it using algebra tiles or another thing, I don't think that devalues what I am teaching in my classroom. You know, I think that I'm covering the material from the curriculum.
And just to add on to that, when we have our own classes, even though we are covering or uncovering the curriculum, sometimes we stress things more than others. And if you have a common evaluation, that may not reflect in that. So we want the assessments to reflect what has happened within that classroom.
Did I say a question over?
Yeah. So I hear you saying that having common standards is equitable, but my claim is that it actually creates inequity in that, and my warrant is that every single step in an assessment is subjective, from what questions we ask, how we phrase them, what we value. And by having common assessments, we're not actually being culturally relevant by incorporating the students that are in our classrooms.
You respond to that? Go ahead, Kelly.
Can I ask you to clarify, when you're talking about the common assessments, do you mean something like ICREO that's right across Ontario, or are you talking within, say, your school district?
It could be both, because districts can be quite large. For example, our district here is from where we are in Orangeville to Guelph, and we have quite a few variants in terms of the students and the communities that we serve.
So I hear what you're saying, where it doesn't necessarily create equity. My claim is that it creates equity with teachers. And my warrant is then you're creating an opportunity for teachers to be able to come together to write these, to collaborate, so teachers don't have to work alone. Teachers can use each other in the most productive, positive way, bounce ideas off of each other, put the needs of their students first, collaborate and co-construct this, co-create it, so that all of the students' needs are being met. So you don't have to work alone. You get to work as a community with your students' needs being put first.
I just want to clarify what our argument is about. Is it about evaluation or assessment? Because we seem to be using the two terms as if they mean the same thing. For me, evaluation is final. So when we have an evaluation, that's it. So I'm not exactly sure how we're helping the student with an evaluation, a common evaluation, how we're bringing them forward. Or are we talking about an assessment like a diagnostic that's going to identify and target the needs of the students who are in front of us?
So one of the things I stated in my opening was that, and I think this actually goes, like, I don't remember a lot that I learned in teachers college, but one of the things they did talk about was like backwards design, like with the end goal in mind, where we want our students to go. And if, as a team, my colleagues and I create where we want kids to go in the end, then the choices I make to help students get there, are benefited from having that end goal in mind and having a clear destination for what I want their learning to look like at the end. And so, whether it's creating that final evaluation collectively and having a common goal as to where our students and what our students will understand by the end of the course, the opportunities along the way to have a common dialogue with our colleagues can then if can affect our assessment practices, our pedagogical choices, and what we're doing with students to move them to that goal. And then, having many hands make light work. So sharing that load across, I think, is a reason why we would want to have common evaluations.
I think my concern, even when we are co-constructing with colleagues, is if we have colleagues who have very different styles in teaching and maybe different ideas of what an assessment should look like. So if we have some colleagues that want to do that traditional paper and pencil, and we have other colleagues who may want to do more of a group work at the board, maybe followed by some paper and pencil, it would be really difficult to come together and to support the students in those individual classes.
The definition that we were working with for evaluation was, what did the students know at the end of a cycle or unit, et cetera? So we were talking about how we would, you know, go about that, figure that out.
And I was just going to say, I feel as though assessment and evaluation is not so black and white. I think they go hand in hand. Your assessment all the way through can turn into your summative evaluation at the end. If you're checking in with your students consistently, daily, having conversations, having observations, that can also be your final evaluation. So one can't exist without the other, I think.
So I'm hearing that there's sort of like two goals there that are a little bit different. I think like Stephen's goals are really to try to make sure that everybody is sort of like the common assessments are to keep people on a similar page, similar goals in mind. And Sherry, you're wanting flexibility because different people do different things. So the common assessments aren't really serving students, but I'm really liking the dialogue because it's like, well, can you have elements that are in common that serve one purpose like that, but allow flexibility around common assessments to then make things? So it's almost like you're asking, like everybody needs to ask in grade 9 to, like, you know, graph this line. Right. But how you do that can be very different. But at least teachers know that I need to ask that question. But then there's also maybe like how you do that. Like maybe you do it in a group, or maybe you do it on paper, pencil, or what have you. So I'm just wondering, like, I'm just trying to synthesize people's ideas. Like, how does that feel to have common flexibility within commonality?
I'll take that. I think certainly always compromise is great. With our curriculum, we have those overall expectations that are expected to be evaluated. So I would hope that those overall expectations are on some sort of summative evaluation to keep those evaluations fairly standard. But as you said, I think it's still super important to make sure that that evaluation reflects what was happening in the class throughout that entire year or semester.
I guess my point was a few points ago, just or a reflection. It's more of a question with all of sort of the commonality, but getting to the flexibility. All of this, these pieces are reminding me of just learning progressions and trajectories and just how valuable those are, and educators having a common goal and understanding where students fall on those and whether that goes with or against whatever you're thinking.
Can I just clarify, are you referring, say, for example, if you administered something to students and you put them on some kind of a continuum, is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, for example, in our board, we use Graham Fletcher's progression, and I'm just thinking of conceptual number sense, you know, knowing that students need to be subitizers and then unitize, and all of those different skills that go into conceptual number sense, early conceptual number sense. And how we use that with assessment and or evaluation, and whether or not we should be using progressions or trajectories.
I think you're asking a great question, and I'm hearing what you're saying. Should we use them or not use them? And I agree with what Stephen said earlier. It's how you use them. It's not whether you should or shouldn't. It's what's driving why you're using them. So if you're using them to enter into conversations around the students, to help them, to nudge them to the next stage on the progression, then it's positive because you're basing it on the conversation is around the students, what the students need, as well as I feel like then you're able to fill the cup of the teachers. If they ask a question like, I'm stuck, I know my students are here, what can we all decide upon as we moderate how to move the students to the next thinking level? Then I think you've done what everyone needs.
Do you have any last questions before we wrap up the questioning round? Okay, I think that's a good note to end on. I just want to take the last 2 minutes here to give Stephen and Sherry a moment to just kind of summarize the main idea of what's really on their mind and one last final statement to you. So I'll start here with Stephen. Stephen, Monica.
I think the one thing that I took away from the questions and the dialogue that we had here is to remember that like the point of any assessment that or evaluation that we create is for the purpose of moving students' understanding forward. And with that in mind, whether we use common or non-common evaluations, what we do with that data, what we do with the information we've gathered from our students is what's important. And that's obviously the goal of all of us as teachers.
And with the final word, Sherry Parentesis.
So just to summarize, I believe that a one-size-fits-all model for common evaluations does not serve our students well. And if we want an assessment that fully demonstrates what our students know, we need to allow them flexibility in how they demonstrate their knowledge.
Thank you. And can we get a round of applause for the debaters? But okay, we're going to get a little meatier here in this debate, our second and final debate here of the afternoon. For this second debate, our topic was, or our resolution was, teachers spend too much time on direct instruction. Teachers spend too much time on direct instruction. And again, we'll start with opening statements. We're going to go back and forth to both sides. So I'm going to start with a side that is in favor of the statement. Teachers spend too much time on direct instruction with Angela Schaefer. Angela, the floor is yours.
Direct instruction needs to be defined. As math teachers, we traditionally understand direct instruction as a teacher lecturing for much, if not most, of the class time, presenting information they want students to digest with a format or procedure to mimic. The teacher would want to concentrate on specific examples and variations that students might see so they know exactly what the teacher wants them to do, and all their solutions should be the same. We claim that teachers need to spend less time on direct instruction. Our warrant is that too much direct instruction is unhealthy and it just does not produce the mathematicians that we want in society. We want our students to be able to reason, prove, and problem solve. Copying teacher examples, memorizing procedures, etc., does not accomplish this goal. Giving students time to play, construct understanding, discuss, and problem solve together is imperative to their growth as a mathematician. Wouldn't it be refreshing to walk past a math class and see and hear student mathematicians rather than a teacher telling students what they should do and how to think?
Thank you. And on the other side of this debate, we're going to start with Steve and Monica. Steve, the floor is yours.
The term direct instruction can encompass a wide range of instructional practices, some of which Angela mentioned. Many of us picture different classrooms when we think of direct instruction. We ourselves may have been successful in that type of classroom. We also may think of our peers who were not successful, or times when we've taught with a direct instruction model and our students have not been successful. Like with any instructional practice, as teachers may choose in their classroom, direct instruction offers a range of practices that may be useful to some of our students. I claim that spending some time on direct instruction could be useful in a math classroom. I have two warrants for this. Direct instruction may help students with acquiring knowledge through their working memory and converting it into long-term memory. Two, teachers need to be comfortable and confident with their instructional practices to perform best for their students. Direct instruction encompasses many instructional practices, some of which may improve our students. And isn't that the point of what we do? Improve our students' learning? And isn't that the point of what we do?
Thank you. And back to the other side with Sherry Parentesis. Sherry, your turn.
I'd like you to take a moment and close your eyes. Put yourself in a student's seat in math class, sitting quietly in single rows, maybe in pairs if your teacher is progressive, and blindly copying a note and writing examples of questions that your teacher has explained, possibly feeling isolated and not 100% sure of what is happening on the board. You may just throw in the towel. What a perfect opportunity to check your social media, text your best friend, or even catch a quick nap. You have just experienced direct instruction. Now picture yourself in a math class where you are encouraged to explore, experience, and collaborate with your classmates. Here, thinking outside the box and making mistakes is not only expected, but respected. This community is where unique strategies are encouraged, individual ways of thinking and knowing are celebrated, and lived experiences are valued. As we open our eyes, we must ask ourselves, is there a time and place for direct instruction? Absolutely there is. It is, in fact, one of many high-impact strategies that can be used in the classroom. The problem, however, is that too many educators are using direct instruction as their main, and in many cases, sole strategy.
Thank you. And with our final opening statement, we have Kelly Madigan. Kelly, the floor is yours.
When I was a young girl, I looked up to superheroes. I, like many my age, would wake up early Saturday mornings to watch my favorite superhero save the day. Now that we are educators, that's exactly what we do today. We inspire our students. We are their superheroes. Today, we are debating how to inspire our students and to be their superheroes through our approaches to teaching. My claim is that direct instruction is necessary, and I have two warrants that support this. My first warrant is that students need strong foundational skills, their own personal schema, in order to be lifelong learners. Without this, they could never participate willingly and confidently in inquiry-based learning. They first need direct instruction in their lives. They do not need complete mastery, but they do need some familiarity. This is achieved through teachers being superheroes and providing students with direct instruction. This form of instruction is intentional and uses clearly communicated learning goals, math vocabulary, key concepts, success criteria, modeling, guided practice, and so much more. For my second warrant, I'd like you to imagine your own classroom. In your classroom, picture it without personalized and individualized feedback, without small flexible groups, without guidance for your students, where your students are not able to have time to make connections with what they are currently learning to what they already know, thus enhancing their schema, where students have not been taught how to think about the reasonableness of their work. If this is unimaginable to you, then imagine a classroom without direct instruction. Direct instruction encompasses all the things that students need to be successful and strive to be superheroes like us with math.
Thank you all for your opening statements. And now I want to open it up for a question round to kind of hear your thoughts. What questions can we ask this panel? And I just want to start off by kind of summarizing. I'm hearing great ideas that you're both recognize there is moments where there should be some direct instruction. The debate is how much and are we spending too much on it? Can I just ask both sides, you, especially Sherry and Kelly, you talked about like our classroom experiences and imagining our classroom. What does the ideal classroom with direct instruction look like? Like how much time or where does direct instruction fall? Sherry?
I think that in many cases, and again, it depends on the expectations. Some expectations like cry out for inquiry and investigation, and other expectations might lead a bit more to direct instruction. But I always think like there has to be a reason that we're learning something. So I like to give a problem where the kids are grappling a bit, knowing at some point they're going to get stuck. And then that's the time to do a short mini direct instruction. So now they need that information, so they want it, and then they can continue with the problem that they're working on.
I hear what Sherry's saying, and I agree. And to answer your question, I don't think it's a time limit. I think in the best case scenario, it would be organic, meaning using what we talked about previously in our first debate, if you're assessing your students and making observations as you're going along,
then you know where their levels of understanding are. And then you're understanding when is time for direct instruction and when is time for inquiry-based learning. I don't think you should be 100% either way.
Okay, let me open up to others for questions to our esteemed panel. Where is your thinking on direct instruction?
Hi there. I'm just wondering if your answers would change based on the panel of students that you're speaking to. Would you give less or more direct instruction, ideally in a secondary classroom versus a grade four classroom, let's say?
Great question.
I hear us keeping talking about like the percentage of time that we spend in direct instruction. I think that I'm from secondary and I just see way too much direct instruction where the teacher is just lecturing and not really allowing time for the students to practice and make some of their own understanding. I don't think it makes any difference. I love doing some inquiry stuff in my grade 10 classroom, and it doesn't seem to matter to me. I've taught it on elementary as well, and we do a lot of play down there, and I think we need to do it much more than we see it in secondary. We definitely need to have it more in secondary.
I'm agreeing with what Angela said. And yes, it definitely depends upon where the students are. And I think what it comes down to then is perhaps a better common understanding of what direct instruction versus inquiry-based learning actually looks like. So perhaps people are misinterpreting what direct instruction is and thinking of it as like the old wording, like the sage on the stage, where you're in the front leading, when in fact that's not what direct instruction is. So perhaps everyone needs just a common conversation of what it is and then implement it into their classrooms.
Can I just point out real quick, I love that we are agreeing on things as adults. And we're also, we talked about in our sessions, we're defining these things more thoroughly. Sorry, Stephen, go ahead.
And so one of the things that I would say that direct instruction does encompass, right, is that it breaks apart what we do into small steps that are manageable for students. It doesn't involves a lot of check-in with students. So there's a lot of like call and response, but not in that like picking on kids way, but like in a meaningful way so that they're actually expressing whether or not they understand what they're doing. And there's regular check-ins with students, and that we also meet students where they are. Like all of those things are principles of direct instruction. And so this idea of sage on stage or sit and get learning, we sometimes think of that as direct instruction, but there's really a lot of facets to direct instruction that are, you know, that may not be readily present in a sit and get classroom and may be present, but that's not really the principles of direct instruction. We need to make sure that we define those things.
And while I agree that when we read about direct instruction, especially in terms of the high instructional strategies, unfortunately, that's not what we're seeing in a lot of classes. And we are still seeing that traditional lecture style. So what Angela and I are talking about is moving away from that traditional direct instruction and more into what we're reading about in terms of high impact strategy.
Is there an overlap or room for an overlap, in your opinion, between direct instruction that would be front-loaded at the beginning of the class versus consolidation at the end? Or do you see consolidation as being completely separate from the direct instruction approach?
I don't think there's ever any one way that is better than another. So as I'd mentioned earlier, there are certain expectations that would call for more direct instruction, maybe a little bit at the beginning. I think what we want to do is keep it short to what is just necessary and just give them enough that they can then work and then maybe consolidate again at the end. So it certainly could come at the beginning as well.
I hear people asking about a definition for direct instruction and whether it occurs at the beginning of the class or at the end of the class as consolidation. I don't know that that matters. As secondary teachers, we get asked at PDs about direct instruction all the time. And they say, oh, it's in that high-packed instructional strategy booklet and we should be doing it. And they are talking about standing at the front and lecturing for 45 to 55 minutes of an hour or an hour and 15-minute period. If you look at the definition, it actually says in high-impact strategies in the government, direct instruction might be seen or might see students gathered on the carpet, seating at their desk, or standing in vertical, permanent, non-permanent surfaces, example, whiteboards, as the educator models specific strategies or tools, asks questions, or monitors student understanding. So if you use that definition, we probably all agree on the panel. But the problem is that educators don't always see direct instruction as that definition.
Thank you for the definition, because that was sort of my comment. Because what I'm hearing is that you are, there's a lot of same thinking or agreement in what direct instruction is or when it is valuable. And I was just thinking to myself here that, is there, like, what can direct instruction look like? And can it be, does it have to be to, for everybody at the same time? Or can it be, like you say, that those sort of conversations that you have while kids are standing at whiteboards, et cetera, and getting involved that way? So thank you.
I think one of the best examples of really good direct instruction is when we see small group instruction and we target a small group of students who might be struggling with a concept. And then for sure that direct instruction is really targeted and helpful. But making sure again that that's one example of when it would be really beneficial.
And I think I'm going to say that there's no specific time to use it in a classroom, because if you're using the high impact instructional strategies that talks about feedback and small groupings and working with students and giving them what they need right in that moment, there is no time. That's ongoing throughout the whole class. So I feel like it's being weaved in with everything else. And maybe that's where sometimes we're getting a little bit stuck thinking about what direct instruction is. It's not just something that's a standalone. It's used in accordance with. So you can still have your inquiry-based learning, but yet be giving feedback to students as they're at a whiteboard, thus giving them direct instruction.
I've heard a lot of questions about when in the lesson or for how long. I'm wondering about when in a student's learning about a concept or a skill, direct instruction might be appropriate. Because I've been thinking about, like, when they're newer to something versus when they're more experienced with something. I'll leave it there.
I think, like, I agree with what you're saying. I think it comes down to the actual student themselves. Inquiry-based learning, if you even take a look at sometimes the way people will approach it, works best for your students that could be sitting at level 3-4 that have, like you said, that conceptual understanding. For your students who are still coming along and are still learning it, I think that's where direct instruction is most necessary for them. Because like you said, then they need that background work. I think sometimes if we look to our ELKP teachers, I feel like they have it down to a science where they're providing some direct instruction and then the students are off in inquiry. And then the teachers are working one-on-one with students after doing assessments based on exactly what they need. The kids are getting what they need at the moment at the right time.
I think we want to sprinkle direct instruction into everything that we do during their learning. So we want to funnel or guide or point students toward a common understanding about concepts or procedures. But they should be short and quick, not standing at the board for 25 minutes and hoping they get it exactly like us and hoping that they, you know, gather all the correct information, but rather allow them to explore with a little bit of guidance so that eventually they come to their own understanding. We don't want stop thinking direct instruction where they are just like, oh, I have to do this way because that's the way the teacher wants.
We have time for one or two more questions.
I'll just
start. Yeah.
I think one other thing that we could look at with the direct instruction is at some point, we have to turn what we're doing with students from working memory into long-term memory. And our working memory is actually really like bad at doing new things. And so we do need like rehearsal of skill and of procedure. And that's a requirement from turning things into from short-term memory into long-term memory. And we want kids to take those the things we're teaching them and put them in their long-term memory so that when we move on to the next thing, we progress further. They're now using the long-term memory in their working memory to move themselves further in the skill. And so direct instruction with good check-in, small group, with feedback, with engaged conversations with students, we have the opportunity to help that working memory turn into long-term memory.
I heard someone say that if they're new to the learning, that's when direct instruction should occur. But would that not prevent you from seeing what they already know instead of assuming that they don't know? Would direct instruction interfere with that?
So I hear you saying that it shouldn't happen really at the beginning of a learning. Yeah, I would actually agree with that. I think it's great to just let them go and explore a little bit first and then start to interject and do some a little bit of direct instruction guidance during their learning experience.
I sometimes think we'll often see at the beginning of a course, a teacher for maybe a couple of days do review from the previous year as direct instruction on the board. And I always think, like, does that honor their previous learning? Are we just assuming they've all forgotten everything and they're all at the same stage? So giving them a chance to show you what they know ahead of time. And then, as Angela said, sprinkling that direct instruction when you see it's needed is, I think, a really good way to go.
I'm agreeing with Angela and Sherry, and I think it comes down to understanding your students and having really in-depth observations of where they are to guide your teaching.
I would disagree to disagree, but there's no point.
Look at all this agreement. I love it.
There are, I think, the advocates of more direct instruction say that that is giving empathy to the novice learner, the students that really are coming in struggling, because I think I'm hearing that people see direct instruction as really beneficial to students that are really struggling. And then also the same folks, they're opponents of thinking classrooms because that is how more expert learners love to learn. And I think it takes off amongst math educators because I think generally we're pretty comfortable with the math. And so that structure, opponents say, it's more geared. That's why we love it as teachers. So what would you say to proponents of direct instruction from the get-go, kind of like what Alita was saying, for a novice learner, as empathy and having more more gradual release of responsibility of learning to later, like with things like random groups and vertical nonprofit, all that stuff. What would you say to them? I guess that's my question.
Just really quickly, I think students will surprise us. And we may think that they're novice and maybe they think they're novice, but given the opportunity, if we let them show what they know, that they may surprise us and they may not be as novice as they think and we think. So I still think it's important to allow for that to happen.
One thing about when students are working at a vertical board on a task is that as a teacher, I can assess that a student is novice at the task or is looking like they don't have the necessary skills to engage with the group. So as a teacher, I mean, that's kind of part of direct instruction. It's like I've now seen a gap or I've seen an opportunity to increase a student's learning, and I can, you know, interject myself in a way that's meaningful to that student. So that may be, hey, come over here. Let's look at this on the board. Do you remember this from grade 8? Do you remember this from, okay, we do. Yeah. Does that see how that works with this? Okay, good. And now I've directly instructed that student and helped them be part of that group or help them work towards, understanding what it is we're working on.
I hear you saying that, like, the novice learner is the one that needs the direct instruction. Is that what you were saying, Jason?
Sorry. I think people are saying that why subject novice learners, students that are really struggling in a rather unstructured learning environment when we know, and a lot of like the research that Stephen is alluding to speaks to direct instruction being very effective for a novice learner. So why would we subject, and again, I'm just saying what they're saying is like, why would we subject students to less effective learning when we know direct instruction or when there is evidence that direct instruction is more effective for those students?
My experience is that those students actually benefit more from having less direct instruction. So I just find that if they have to mimic or follow or try to do things correctly, they don't engage with the learning in the same way. So if students have a chance to monitor and evaluate their own thinking before they're just trying to figure out what the teacher's thinking, then they actually engage in the learning a little bit better. And then we can interject during that learning process and guide and direct their instruction and their understanding at that point.
And I also think if we have students in our class who come into a class already feeling that they're not good math students, they have the opportunity, if it's set up correctly, to have those aha moments when they're able to figure something out on their own. And I think those are the powerful moments that start making them feel like a math person. But just having someone tell you to do it and then you can do it, you kind of rob them of those little opportunities when they can go, yes, like I got it. I finally figured that out. And I think those are the little moments that really are important.
But I'm agreeing with what Jason said. I feel like if you think about something that's completely brand new to you, so if you were taking a cooking class or perhaps a brand new carpentry class and you're a novice learner, maybe you have some background knowledge, but you're coming in, someone first modeling it, giving you that little nugget might give you that confidence to jump in and even go further than into inquiry-based learning. So I feel like you need that direct instruction for those students who are not feeling confident right away so they can get the skills they need to feel confident and then to flourish.
Any last questions? One last one over here.
So for the voices who cling to direct instruction because they see their primary purpose as needing to cover the curriculum and that there's not enough time to cover the full curriculum and ensure that they're doing their students justice, if they're using that inquiry approach, what is your response or thoughts towards their concerns?
I have found as we've used more exploratory instruction, we're able to cover so much more material so much faster. I don't think it's a time issue at all. I think it's the opposite. I think we can cover so much more material and we can cover multiple concepts and they see the connections. I remember my kids when they were in kindergarten, they'd come home and say, and the connection is, because their kindergarten teacher always talked about that. And I feel like we don't do enough of that in high school. And the more I teach with this exploratory way and developing constructive understanding, they start to see those connections and we could cover so much so fast.
I think what I'm hearing is that teachers at the end of the day are most worried about their students and want to cover that curriculum and they want them to know everything. But I think they're using direct instruction wrong. I don't think that is true direct instruction. I think that is, unfortunately, the old adage of sage on the stage, really honestly believing that they're doing the best for their students because they want them to learn. But I think then they need a better understanding of what direct instruction is and need to implement that as opposed to just doing like he said yesterday, the person doing all the talking is doing all the learning, and that's not what direct instruction should be.
Okay, let me pause there. Let me give you all just a few seconds to kind of ponder the arguments, think about it, and then we're going to, in 30 seconds, have some closing statements. Just take a moment to think and reflect on what you've heard, maybe even whisper to a neighbor about what's standing out to you. Yeah. Just to end, to wrap things up, we're going to go back to Angela and Sherry for their closing thoughts.
I just want to repeat that our claim is that direct instruction, as sage on the stage, should be limited. Our warrant is that by letting students play and construct their understanding with minimal direction from the teacher, students will become the mathematicians we desire, people that can reason, evaluate, and problem solve effectively. These skills will make them a productive member of society.
Thank you. And final thoughts from the other side, Kelly and Stephen.
I may have watched superheroes on the TV when I was a child, but this afternoon, the superheroes are before me. You may be unable to fly or to lift cars over your head, but you have all left a lasting, significant superhero impression on your students. You have all worked tirelessly to ensure that they are getting the best education possible and that they are all important learners and junior superheroes. For that to have happened and to continue happening, we must ensure that direct instruction and a common understanding of it is always a part of our teaching pedagogy.
And thank you. Can we get a round of applause for these debaters? You did it. And that's it. Those are our live debates from February of 2024. I want to give a huge thank you to OMCA for inviting us in and letting us record this debate and for the four debaters who did an excellent job. I hope you enjoyed, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on social media. Want to learn more about incorporating debate activities into your math classroom? go to luzniak.com/podcast to sign up for my mailing list and get your first set of example debate activities you could use with your students today. Go to luzniak.com/podcast.
Don't forget to reach out to us with comments and questions on debatemath.com or follow us on Twitter @debatemathpod and follow along with #debatemathpod.
Rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts
or wherever you listen to this podcast. Your feedback is super important to us.
Well, that's all from us.
Looking forward to debating with you more next episode. Until next time, cheers.